At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. You got $5.5 trillion? Also, any chance you want to run the Fed? Lots going on today in Fed and taxes. From American Public Media, this is MarketPlace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 1st of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let me just say that if somehow it escaped your notice that A, the Federal Reserve was meeting on interest rates this week, and B, a decision on who is going to run the Fed for the next 4 years is still theoretically up in the air, well, it is not for our lack of trying, let me tell you that. The Fed wrapped up its aforementioned meeting today. No change in interest rates, thank you very much. And economic activity is, quote, rising at a solid rate despite hurricane-related disruption. So there is that. Now, though, about the fate of the incumbent chair, Janet Yellen. President Trump was asked about her at the tail end of a quick press availability today.
I think Janet Yellen is excellent.
Is she your
I think she's excellent. I didn't say that. I think she's excellent. Go ahead. Thank you very much.
Didn't say she was the choice, not a ringing endorsement, which helps explain why current board member Jay Powell is the front runner to get the job when the announcement comes. Tomorrow is what we're being told. But look, Fed chairs come and Fed chairs go. Their job, though, remains the same. The Fed's dual mandate of maximum employment and stable prices. MarketPlace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going with a primer.
The Fed chair is the face of the Fed. A lot of the job boils down to style. The chair leads the Federal Open Market Committee meetings where interest rates are set, and each has a different style.
Alan Greenspan was known for speaking first.
Ann Owen is a former Fed economist, now at Hamilton College.
And then when Ben Bernanke took over, he did exactly the opposite. He spoke last.
If the Fed chair speaks first, other committee members may be reluctant to contradict him or her. If speaking last, the chair tends to be more of a consensus builder, like Janet Yellen. After the meetings, the chair translates those closed-door interest rate decisions to the public, either at a press conference,
the economy continues to expand at a moderate pace,
or on Capitol Hill. Congress established the Fed's dual mandate in the Federal Reserve Act of 1977 to carefully monitor inflation and unemployment because
they're the best measures of the underlying direction of the economy.
Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at Stifel Fixed Income. The Fed's target for inflation is 2%. It tries to keep unemployment between 4 and 5%. In theory, if the Fed fulfills this mandate, economic growth will be perfect. Frank Notaft is another former Fed economist.
It is this balancing act between the maximum possible employment consistent with low and stable inflation.
Whatever the style of the Fed chair, that's the goal. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for MarketPlace.
I'm pretty sure I speak for all the business and economic journalists out there when I say we're a bit deflated today. We were promised a tax bill this morning. We didn't get it because the word is Republican leaders are still trying to figure out a way to pay for $5.5 trillion in tax cuts over the next 10 years. MarketPlace's Tracy Samuelson looks at how the GOP gets from here to there.
There's the math, the politics, and the policy. Right now, GOP lawmakers are pulling levers, turning dials, trying to write a bill that can balance all three. First, the math. Mark Mazur is the director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
Almost any of the revenue raisers that you're looking for to make the numbers work will have a substantial number of opponents.
Which brings in the politics.
And the politics typically don't break out on partisan lines. They break out on geographic lines or industry lines or demographic lines.
For example, eliminating state and local deductions would raise real revenue, but it's a tough sell in a state like New York, where today a Republican congressman said it's too big a hit for his state. John Gimigliano is the head of federal tax legislative services at KPMG.
Of course, it hurts some people, depending on your state, more than others. But the question is, in the bigger context, what are you getting in return?
That leads us to policy. Republicans say they want this tax overhaul to benefit the middle class, not the wealthy. Ray Beeman, a principal at Ernst & Young, says when you're pulling lots of levers at the same time, it can have unintended consequences.
When you thought you might be providing a middle-class tax cut, the combination of policies could, in fact, do the opposite. And so a lot of this is just going back to the drawing board over and over again and trying to get the numbers to work right.
So to make tomorrow's deadline, GOP lawmakers still have lots of promises to keep and miles to go before they sleep. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Nice. Wall Street today, a little bumpy. Talk of a Fed rate hike in December. Delays in tax land. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a name from the economic mists, Ronald Reagan. The 40th president of the United States is invoked not infrequently to suit a variety of Republican needs, most recently in the tax debate that we are having right now. It can be useful, though, to study history before invoking it, which is what Bruce Bartlett has done. The one-time economic policy advisor in the Reagan White House wrote in the Washington Post not too long ago about what he calls the Republican tax myth. Mr. Bartlett, it's good to have you on.
Happy to be here.
Do me a favor and remind us, would you, what the Republican tax myth is?
The biggest Republican tax myth is that we had vast prosperity in the 1980s that dwarfed the growth in any other time period, and that this was totally and exclusively the result of the 1981 tax cut. And this is just total mythology. Real economic growth in the 1980s was less than it was in the 1970s, or the 1990s.
And yet now here we are a generation or more later, and tax cuts are still, you write, the go-to solution for Republicans.
That's right. They believe in one-size-fits-all economics, or cookie-cutter economics, if you'd rather. There's one policy and one policy only to deal with any economic problem that ever comes up, and that is tax cuts for the rich.
The theory being, of course, that, listen, if we cut taxes on the rich and if we cut taxes on companies, that money will get out into the rest of the economy. Workers will get that $4,000 wage that the White House talks about, and everything's going to be rosy.
Yeah, of course, this is just complete nonsense. I think in their heart of hearts, they believe that only the wealthy really help the economy. And they believe that the wealthy just carry the rest of us on their backs, that we're all worthless. And only the Charles Kochs and Robert Mercers of the world really add economic value to the economy. And, of course, this is just utterly ridiculous.
So what's the answer then to what might constitute a sensible overhaul of the American tax system? Because everybody pretty much agrees it's cumbersome and bloated and it needs to be reshaped for a new economy. What's the answer?
Well, I think they should follow the example of Ronald Reagan. The 1986 tax reform was very good piece of legislation, and the reason it worked is three key principles were followed. They got rid of tax loopholes to pay for a reduction in tax rates. Secondly, it was distributionally neutral. It gave roughly the same percentage tax cut to everybody, regardless of their tax bracket. And the third thing is it was genuinely bipartisan. And the Republicans today have rejected all three principles.
What about this idea that you hear from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin quite a bit and also Gary Cohn, that these tax cuts are going to pay for themselves with economic growth?
No tax cut in history has ever done that. We just had a recent example in the state of Kansas where Arthur Laffer promised that the huge tax cut that the Republicans enacted would pay for itself. And of course, it did not. Revenues hemorrhaged. And the first reaction that Republicans had, they said, we must cut spending for education, for the poor, for roads, for many, many other programs that are popular with voters. And eventually they did finally have to reverse themselves. I think pretty much the same thing is going to happen at the federal level.
Myths become myths because they endure for a very long time. Why do you think this Republican tax myth has lasted so long?
I think part of it is simple ignorance. People don't know history. But a part of it is that they believe what they want to believe. They want to believe that taxes are too high. I mean, Donald Trump constantly says we're the highest tax nation on earth, which is just a rank lie. I don't think he's confused. He's been told by his own staff on many occasions that that is absolutely not true. And so, but he keeps saying it because, unfortunately, there are a lot of people in his party who simply want to believe that, and they don't care whether it's true or not.
Bruce Bartlett was an economic policy advisor for President Reagan, also George H.W. Bush. His new book is called The Truth Matters. Mr. Bartlett, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Taxes are going up here in California today. Gas taxes, to be specific, by 12 cents a gallon. Car registration fees are going up as well. Revenue gain should be $54 billion to Sacramento over the next 10 years to pay for repairs to roads and highways and bridges. California is, of course, not the only state with big infrastructure needs, but as Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth explains, it might be the only state, or one of them anyway, to use this solution.
Some residents of California's Central Valley heard this on the radio last week.
Ever wonder why our gas prices are higher than other states?
That ad calls out a local lawmaker who supported the new gas tax. It was funded by a California Farmers Association, and they're not the only ones mad about the tax hike. It affects nearly everyone in car-crazy California, and the poor will feel that extra 12 cents a gallon more than the rich.
The gas tax is unwarranted.
John Kupal is a fiscal conservative and president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. He admits California's highways are in bad shape, but Kupal says
our existing gas tax is sufficient to take care of those needs.
He believes lawmakers are to blame for wasteful spending. Rick Geddes, who teaches infrastructure policy at Cornell, says California might be the only state where a new gas tax can survive politically. Most other places,
it's really politically suicidal.
He says other states are trying different ways to raise money for infrastructure. In Oregon, drivers are charged per mile of road they use. Virginia has raised its sales tax and earmarked that money for road fixes. Some states are adding new toll lanes.
So the political folks who realize they need more funding have to think about those alternatives.
One thing all 50 states have in common, Getty says, they're not waiting around for any federal help. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth. For Marketplace.
At the EPA this week, there were some new science advisors announced, ostensibly the top independent experts in their respective fields, independent being the key word there. From the sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
Is fracking a risk to drinking water? How much air pollution is okay? Those are the kinds of questions the EPA Science Advisory Board takes on. And the brand new head of that board is Michael Honeycutt, a Texas state regulator who rolled back rules on 45 chemicals. The head of a separate EPA board on air pollution has done work for fossil fuel and chemical groups. It all worries Michael Halpern at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
It's really up to the Science Advisory Board and any type of administration to set the record straight. Scott Pruitt is taking what should be a sounding board and turning it into an echo chamber.
This administration has already overruled its science advisors once by keeping a controversial pesticide on the market. And putting friendly scientists on the boards has long been a goal of regulated companies, says Johns Hopkins epidemiologist Tom Burke. He has served on past EPA science boards.
Those folks who've been impacted by EPA science have unfortunately always sought ways to push back on the scientific process.
EPA head Scott Pruitt frames conflict of interest differently. At the agency yesterday, he said academic scientists who get government money, they are the suspect ones.
When we have members of those committees that have received tens of millions of dollars in grants, at the same time that they're advising this agency on rulemaking, that is not good and that's not right.
A spokesman says the EPA needs scientists who, quote, understand the regulated community. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
But you don't want to subsidize some child's ski lessons in Aspen.
No, you don't. Down in the weeds of the tax code. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 57 points today, about 0.25%, 23,435. The NASDAQ off 11, 0.1%, 6716. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, about 0.1%, 2579. Bank stocks rose after the Fed announced it is not going to raise interest rates. Bank of America added 0.5%. Citigroup up about 0.7%. J.P. Morgan Chase was up 0.3%. Gotta say, though, the Fed did hint that December rates are going up then, so look for that. New York Times said digital revenue and online subscriptions grew robustly in the third quarter. That is the good news that is fit to print. The bad? Print revenue declined 20%. Shares of the Times lost 5.7%. Today, cosmetics company Estee Lauder surprised with better earnings and revenues thanks to strong sales in Hong Kong and China. Shares up 9% today. Bonds up, yields down 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Tyson Foods, which isn't just Tyson Chicken, by the way. You got Jimmy Dean Sausages and Hillshire Farm and Ballpark Franks. Tyson is a company right at the top of the American corporate food chain. Tom Hayes is the president and CEO. We got him on the phone from Arkansas, where Tyson is based, for the latest installment of our series, Conversations from the Corner Office. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Really happy to be here.
When you took over this gig a year-ish ago, what were the first couple of things you were thinking you had to do for this company?
You know, I didn't start out kind of thinking about, you know, what are all the things that I can bring necessarily. It was more about how can I just do a good job and really have a positive impact on the team members. So continuing the mode of growing and growing in a way that we can all be proud of.
You did do a couple of things right away, though, right? You made the announcement about getting rid of antibiotics in some of your chickens. You talked about worker safety protocols for 95,000 of your employees here in the United States. I have to imagine you took those with an eye on the realities of food as an industry, but also the long-term sustainability and survivability of this company in an environment and an economy that is changing.
Yeah, no question. You know, the decision on antibiotics was pretty easy to make, hard to execute, but pretty easy to make.
Why hard to execute? Couldn't you just sign a piece of paper and say, make this happen?
Our team members would be really disappointed if they heard me say that. No, because, you know, the operations have to be absolutely clean overall from every part of the supply chain on poultry. And so we had been doing a great job, and we had been pushing towards that end for, you know, I'd say the last 7 or 8 years. And we are now the world's largest producer of no antibiotic ever chicken.
Can we talk scale here for a second? Obviously, Tyson is one of the biggies. As we consider the companies that sell, in essence, protein to us, how important is it to be the biggest?
I don't think it's important to be the biggest. What is important is that the biggest do the things that are the most important. We got a lot of challenges getting, you know, quality food at an affordable price to the tables of folks in the U.S. For sure, but it's also a global challenge. The backyard farms are excellent, and a lot of people enjoy them, but the world's problems are not going to be solved through backyard farms alone. Big food needs to get into the conversation and, you know, face up some of the realities of dealing in big food and to help and change the way that agriculture is going to evolve.
Let me throw a phrase at you here and get your reaction. You ready?
Yeah.
Plant-based protein.
Yeah, love it.
You know, for, well, all right, so first of all, do you eat plant-based protein?
I do. Full disclosure, I'm more of a animal protein lover.
Fair enough. Me too.
Certainly, you know, at Tyson, we were all about protein. So for us, you know, we want to look at anything that consumers want, as well as can be an affordable, sustainable technology to leverage to help, you know, feed the world on a sustainable basis. So absolutely, plant protein. Very excited about it.
A word here about the political environment in which this economy finds itself right now. Of the things that are happening in Washington, I imagine tax reform, tax overhaul is the biggest thing for you. What are you looking for out of Washington on that?
We're big fans of lower taxes for corporations, for sure.
Shocking.
Yeah, shocking, exactly. Well, you know, I think it's fine to, you know, want that, have a lower tax base. You know, we have consistently been putting more of our income into wages, putting more of our cash to work in capital investment. So I think it's overall a good thing, but specific to Tyson, it would certainly be extraordinarily welcome if the rate comes down.
Let me push you on that a little bit, right? Because the White House has been saying, you know what, this is going to get a middle-class family an average raise of $4,000. Are you going to give your workers a $4,000 raise if you get a corporate tax cut?
We've been giving raises consistently. So I think there will be a part of that that does go back. And for us, we will do things that do benefit our team members, whether it's directly in wages or, you know, adding capital to facilities that we might not have been otherwise. There's not a lot of that, but I say for sure it caused us to be making investments for our company in terms of growth and adding jobs.
Tom Hayes is the president and CEO of Tyson Foods. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're going to put the whole conversation Tom and I had in our Corner Office podcast. We talked about safety for food factory workers, some of the new technologies Tyson is working on as well. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. One more piece of tape from President Trump today from that same cabinet meeting earlier when he was asked about Fed Chair Yellen. The president also spent some time listing the virtues of the tax bill that rumor has it we are going to see tomorrow. Among those virtues, he said, is this.
We'll make the tax code simple and fair so that the vast majority of Americans can file their taxes on a single sheet of paper. We will be simplifying. It'll be called simplification. Our tax code.
From the marketplace desk of Hoo Boy, easier said than done, here's Adrienne Hill.
This is a story about the weeds of the tax code. The deep, thick, jungly weeds. Section, subsection, a tangle of vines, fertilized in part by the tax evaders, the loophole hunters.
People like to cheat, and they like to take advantage of the rules.
Adam Chatero is a tax law professor at Arizona State University. He says where there's a tax advantage, there will be people trying to figure out how to sneak, wiggle, twist their way into getting that break.
And so a lot of the complexity in the tax code is actually anti-abuse rules, trying to prevent taxpayers from taking improper advantage of the sort of structure of the tax code.
Imagine you're the lawmaker.
Say you want to subsidize child care.
That's Bill Gale, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. So you, the lawmaker, propose a tax break for child care.
But you don't want to subsidize some child's ski lessons in Aspen.
Because, yeah, those ski instructors might be taking care of your kids while they teach them to slalom. But it's not really the point of the tax break. So rules and regulations get written about what counts and what doesn't.
The line that you draw has to cover all possible activities and place them clearly on one side of the line or the other.
It gets complex fast. A crafty taxpayer out there might still try to find a way around the rules, try to figure out how to get those ski lessons covered. So the IRS writes new rules.
And so something gets patched on and then something gets patched on top of that.
Each patch makes the code denser and denser. So how do you actually achieve tax code simplification? You can't just whack down the vines. That would just open up more holes for the cheats. To really simplify, you gotta dig up the roots.
One way around the complexity is just to eliminate a lot of deductions and credits.
Mark Luscombe is an analyst at Wolters Kluwer Tax and Accounting.
If you just eliminate the deduction, then you get rid of the complexity that goes along with it.
That's part of what the GOP has in mind with this tax bill. But the current tax code is thick with these breaks. To be a little cliche, simplification is never as easy as it sounds, which is part of the reason, no doubt, for all this last-minute scrambling. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one more bite at the tax bill apple before it comes out tomorrow. We think tomorrow anyway. ABC News reports today that there is some back and forth going on between the White House and congressional Republicans over the official title of the thing. It's not clear what Republicans on the Hill want to call it, but President Trump apparently has his mind made up. It will be called, if the president gets his way, according to ABC News, the Cut, Cut, Cut Act. I'm obliged to note here, for purposes and reasons of accuracy, the tax cuts are not tax reform. Okay, got to go. The Dow up 57 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ lost 11 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 up 0.4%. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Josted, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.